SF Signal, Episode 78, Panel Topic, Visions of the Future. SF Signal. This is the SF Signal Podcast, as powered by the Functional Nerds. My name is Patrick Hester. I'm an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd, and we're back for another panel. This week, I've got several guys here. None of the ladies were available to join us. I'm sure someone will hate me for that. Let's go down the list and say hello, first off, to Paul Weimer.
Hello, Paul Weimer here. I blog at SF Signal. I blog at Functional Nerds. I blog at my own site. I send pictures every day on the internet. I comment here, there, and everywhere, and all that's good stuff. Hi, everyone.
Nice. Hi. Well done. John Stevens.
John Stevens, writer, blogger, bon vivant. I have a column for SF Signal, The Bellowing Ogre, and I just had a nonfiction piece published in Apex Magazine on Lovecraft in the 21st Century, and I blog at jhstevenswordpress.com.
Very cool. Mr. Jeff Patterson.
If he's a bon vivant, I am a man about town. I blog at Gravity Lens, which can be found at baddaystudio.com. And I actually posted something this week for SF Signal.
I saw that. Yeah, that was good. Space 1999. I remember that.
Never forget.
Yeah, I think I was like five.
Well, I wasn't.
I know. That's why I said that. Jamie Todd Rubin.
Hello, everybody. Jamie Todd Rubin, science fiction writer and blogger. I do the Wayward Time Traveler column for SF Signal. And I've been dealing with a colicky baby all day today.
Yeah.
I bet that's fun. You know, they got a new show coming on NBC about a baby that's up all night and won't go to sleep. I give it like 3 months. Tops. So we're here to talk about something. We have a topic, don't we? Yes, we do. Here it is. Visions of the future. Science fiction authors have always been looking towards the future. Which authors have created the most memorable visions of the future? Which have created your absolute favorite? And which created your least favorite? Let's start with Gene Roddenberry. Paul Weimer.
Okay. Well, the problem with science fiction futures is that most futures are really alternate histories as we go forward and forward in time past the publication.
You don't know that.
Well, it gets longer. It gets more and more difficult to see how we get there from here as we go further and further in the future and events don't happen, such as Heinlein's Future History, for example, which Jamie's been looking at in his Wayward Time Travel column. Jamie's column on his site. Anyway, as far as favorite futures, or my favorite futures are the ones where we explore the universe.
Yeah, that's not going to happen anymore. NASA's dead.
Well, actually, the one I was thinking of has nothing to do with NASA, and that would be the Commonwealth Universe of Peter F. Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
Wormholes to other planets, anti-aging, what's not to like? And no NASA spaceships to keep us going around the Earth in circles, or not, as the case may be.
You know, I give NASA a hard time, but honestly, they've supposedly come up with a new hard fuel rocket that's going to launch in 2017, and that's going to be their new thing. So we'll just have to wait and see what that does. Let's talk to Jamie, since you mentioned him. Jamie.
Well, let's see. I'm pretty old school with some of these things, and Paul alluded to that. I still have to say that my favorite is Isaac Asimov's Foundation series and the vision that he has there, not because it's some idyllic vision, but because it's one of those far future things that every time I finish reading that series, and I think I've read the entire thing six or seven times, and the additional Benford, Brin, and Bear books a couple of times. Every time I get finished reading it, I think, this is the kind of future that I would want to live in. Granted, there are bad things that happen in that future, but it's not perfect. But it's just the vision of it is one that I really like. I also like some of the stuff that's in Jack McDivitt's Alex Benedict and Chase Kolpath novels. That's also pretty far future, and it's not particularly dark. And because I like the light stuff, what can I say? And it's there's still recognizable humanity there.
John Stevens.
I'm dark.
I'm Batman.
If Jamie is the light, I am the darkness in the universe.
That's a good Batman voice.
I'm Batman.
That's right. I had a hard time with the question because I do read a lot of, because it's one of my, it was one of my areas of specialization when I was in academia, was talking about utopia and dystopia and utopia and all those topias. And I tended to go for the darker stuff, the sort of more post-apocalyptic and dystopic stuff. I was trying to think of a favorite future, and I think I thought about the question in the wrong way initially, as like the one I would most want to live in. And I realized I don't know that there is one in science fiction that I actually want to live in. But one that came to mind is one that I find really interesting to think about because it brings up so many issues is probably a Chris Moriarty's like Spin State and Spin Control universe, which is sort of post-human and has a lot of very advanced science and space travel and all that stuff, but has a lot of human issues that emerge from that. I mean, she tackles a lot of issues of gender and sexuality and politics, and it has a very good feel as maybe not a possible future, but a plausible future. Like with all those advances, we still remain human, and it's still a struggle to live. And that really appeals to me. And I couldn't, it was hard to think of like a least liked future. I mean, there are futures that are less plausible, certainly. And there's some that I don't think did what the author intended them to do. Like John C. Wright's very far, you know, deeply philosophical future just felt kind of empty of humanity to me. And I think for me, the key is with anything is how much it resonates with my ideas of what being a human is. Like Paulo Baca Galuppi's Wind Up Girl is a great book, and it's not a very happy future. There's a certain plausibility to it. But also at the same time, there's sort of a, it's almost too much. Like he's striving for a certain amount of science fictional realism in what he's, the world that he's positing. And yet it feels like maybe it's a little too close to the edge. And that could be because there is a lot of resonance with where we think things are going now sometimes. And it's very human, but then it seems to go a little too far in terms of some of the effects it posits. So I found it to be kind of a thorny question to navigate, but when I got down to it, I thought the future that most seemed interesting to me to further explore would be probably the one Chris Moriarty posits in her books.
Well, I know that Jeff Patterson really liked what Will Smith did with iRobot and what Clooney did with Solaris. Didn't you, Jeff?
Oh yeah. Oh, it was so wonderful. I watch it every night. it's kind of weird because all this discussion of light and dark, and when I think about the futures, I tend to think more about the settings than I do about the actual stories. And I've mentioned before that I've always had this strange fascination with that kind of consensus future that sort of emerged out of the 70s with lots of, centralized space exploration projects and mass transit that works efficiently. A lot of the Ben Bova and James Hogan especially like to deal with that, 50 years from now, everything will be wonderful. And Fred Paul and Larry Niven kind of played with it in various degrees along that same sort of period of time. And it kind of sidestepped the whole AI, and it sidestepped the internet as we know it now and stuff like that. But one of the things that always appealed to me about it, strangely enough, when you talk about light and dark, I'm going to go a little neutral here, was the fact that it was very as a setting, it was very utilitarian. And not only that, but it was also very unromantic. There was, it was the fact that it was a world that worked better than ours did and was faster and quicker and had a lower failure rate that sort of made it appealing. It was kind of like, gee, this will be neat. You'll be able to get into your personal train car in your garage, and it will hook you up to a string of them, which take you across the country through a vacuum tube under the ground inside of 20 minutes, et cetera. And I think that's one of the reasons why that concentric future, why that consensus future had the longevity that it did for such a period of time. I mean, it definitely grew out of the 50s and 60s, but it definitely put its nice little shiny stamp on it. That being said, when it comes to futures I'd like to live in, I mean, certainly, you know, Peter Hamilton has a wonderful one because he makes the culture look as interesting as it does. But I also like a lot of the Robert Reed stuff, Robert Reed's Sister Alice stories, which are really far future, which have sort of a, man goes post-human and expands into the universe and what happens to the people that stay behind. I've always found that very, very compelling. Would I like to live in it? Maybe not necessarily, but I do sort of like the that stream of the culture that remains native when everybody else expands. Silverberg sort of played with that in Nightwings a little bit as well. But I don't know. I've sort of always had a which is strange because I'm not a real homebody and I'm not a very homey person, but I sort of like the premise of doing that.
By the way, just since you mentioned Silverberg, I got to throw it out there again that at the Hugos, he killed.
Oh, he always does.
It was the funniest thing I have witnessed in a very long time. I my side was hurting. I was laughing so hard. I was listening to, and I honestly don't remember what I listened to so much stuff. I was listening, I want to say, to something on the radio, and there was a guy talking about how human beings always gravitate towards the doom and gloom. And so he said, if you go back, it doesn't matter how far back you go, you'll always have someone running around saying, you know, there's too many people. We're going to eat all the food. There's not going to be enough food. Just to illustrate the point, you know, that we always look at the dark side. And so a lot of the future stuff is always very dark. We're going through wars. We've used up all the Earth's resources. You know, we're dying out as a species. Why do you think that is? Why do you think we go there? Anybody?
Well, I'll jump in here. I mean, to me, I think it sounds like a reflection of human anxiety. It's, you know, it's just everybody has anxiety about something, some more than others. And I think, I don't know, being a writer and knowing writers tend to have a little extra anxiety, maybe not knowing whether what their writing is gonna be any good or anything like that.
I can tell you right now, as a wannabe writer, we have zero anxiety whatsoever. We're absolutely 100% confident in everything that we write.
I think that coupled with the fact that there's just, you know, everyday anxiety about the future that gets reflected in the stories.
Anybody else?
Yeah, I sort of take it slightly different. I view it as a, I don't know, I tend to think that the people that really are drawn to the real dark stuff and make a big deal out of the fact that they're drawn to the doom and gloom tend to have it really good, whether they know it or not, you know. And I think that I'd be very curious if we were to go into an actual full-blown, you know, depression, if we actually had, you know, if science fiction had existed in a very robust form during the Great Depression or during the post-war years in Europe when they were rebuilding and stuff like that, I'm kind of curious what would have been popular, you know?
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about, you know, dark futures, I've heard of a series of books called, you know, the first one was A World Without Bagels. The next one was Rise of the Planet Without Bagels. And then there was Return of the Bagels. And so that was, you know, a very dark future. And I think that story was actually written specifically for SF Signal. So
yeah, but nobody counts the last one as canon, so.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that. So I'm just curious. I'm curious. When you look at the different futures that people have written about, do you see any that you think that, like, they've gotten it right in some respect? You know, a lot of people point to Star Trek. because, you know, they had the communicators and now we have the flip phones, and they had, you know, the pads, the PADDs, and now we have the tablet computers. What about other things that people have gotten right?
I think we seem to be living in a combination William Gibson, Bruce Sterling sort of future world. I mean, you look at novels like, say, Heavy Weather and look at climate change today, or the interconnected world that we have and look at the stuff that Gibson has done. I think we sort of didn't wind up with the space travel world of some of the other classic SF authors, but we've wound up in this interconnected world full of communications technology and climate change. Basically, William Gibson and Bruce Sterling have created our present and our future.
Yeah, I'm still pissed off at Hanna-Barbera for not, you know, I think they were the ones in charge of the Jetsons, and we still don't have the flying cars.
Alas.
Or the robot to clean the house.
I'd go one more. If you're going to dip into cyberpunk, I really think that the Buddha Inn stories by George Alec Effinger, I think those probably hit closer to home than a lot of the stuff that Gibson did. I mean,
good point, Jeff.
He really played into a lot of economics and
speak into your microphone, Jeff.
I'm sorry, racial sociologies and stuff like that I think we've really started to come to play. I mean, I just reread When Gravity Fails a little while ago, and it was kind of like, yikes, this is sort of nails a lot of it on the head. So.
Well,
you know, I would
agree with that.
I would say that, you know, from the stuff that I've been reading, a lot of the Golden Age stuff, we're so far ahead of that now where that was. That, you know, predictions in science fiction are sort of a questionable thing anyway. But what I think the scientific predictions haven't maybe been as good, but some of the sociological ones have been pretty good. Isaac Asimov's first story in Astounding was Trends. It was actually Ad Astra, and title was Change to Trends. And it was all about opposition to the space race. And flying to the moon, and you know, Campbell at the time thought that was a unique idea. Who would oppose space travel? But that was what the story was about. Lester Del Rey had another story. I believe it was the Stars Look Down. Not much later, maybe a year later or so, which was about the competition between two companies for building a rocket to the. I think it was to the moon. But it was sort of that sort of looking more at today, where, you know, NASA, as we started out talking about, NASA's out of the game, or seems like it's out of the game, and it's going to be up to corporations to take the load. And this was a sort of an early story, sort of looking at that and saying, how are these going to compete? There's corporate espionage. Who's going to have the technology? How are we going to get around regulations and things like that? So, but again, it's sort of, you know, it's a crapshoot in the sense that, you know, there's a lot of luck involved in those kind of predictions, I think.
Well, and you know, again, just briefly about NASA, they're not the only game in town, but they've been the leader for a long time. And now, you know, they're kind of being pulled back. And so it does give other countries and corporations a chance to shine a little bit. But supposedly this new rocket that they're working on, I guess the rockets that go up right now use liquid fuel, and they can push up 30 tons. And what they're looking at is this new rocket will be closer to like 130. And so it's going to be able to deliver not only a payload, but also a 6-person crew, similar to what the space shuttle could do. But they see it as being their platform, not only to get back up into orbit, but to go beyond, even maybe to Mars. But
you know, it's funny.
We're 20 years out, or no, we're 10 years out from a manned mission. If everything gets approved.
It's funny you mention that, because I'm, you know, reading the news about, you know, the plans for the ISS in the next couple months, and the fact that we may actually have an abandoned space station in orbit around us, which is never a good thing. That's how all the really, you know, rough movies always start.
Yep.
Right. Well, and that's the thing that, you know, we're talking about, you know, what futures, what did people get right? You know, I don't remember. I mean, and there's folks on the line here probably know a lot more than I do about this, but I don't remember reading stories, especially the older stories, where the prediction was, we were going to go to the moon. We were going to spin around in orbit for a little while, and then it was all going to stop. We weren't going to go back. We weren't going to end up putting people on Mars for many, 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 many years afterwards. We weren't going to go to the asteroids. We weren't going to go to, you know, Venus or anything like that. And that's where we are right now. And I'm hard-pressed to think of stuff, at least stuff from the early days where that was the prediction.
Well, in those stories where people were pushing forward and they kept on exploring and they kept on going, there were no bagels.
Hey, Jamie, I got one, actually. Heinlein's future history. As I recall, after the U.S. space travel basically ends for several decades, you still have the colony on Venus and stuff still going on by itself, but space travel ends for, like, several generations. As
that's right. That's right. You're right.
And then it picks up again.
Well, and so you look at, like, and I always go back to, like, Star Trek. Star Trek, what they did, you know, we're supposed to be in the middle of a world war right now. Like the eugenics and all that kind of crap going on right now.
Past it, man.
Yeah, and then there's, like, nothing for a very long time, and then people kind of start rebuilding, and then they, you know, apparently get the attention of the Vulcans. And then a crappy show. I, you know, well, you also look at, and I'm just looking at television. So you had Space 1999, obviously. They thought we would be further along. They thought we would have a moon base to collect nuclear waste in 1999.
We're going to talk television futures, man. Galactica 1980.
Yeah, Galactica. Buck Rogers, DBDBDB. You've had lots of different things where that, you know, they always kind of look like we're out there, we're doing stuff, and the reality is, I think it just takes a lot longer. I think that they, in the 60s, they pushed really, really hard to get to the moon, and they cut a lot of corners, I think, to get there, and then they kind of set back and say, okay, now that we've done that, let's not do that so much anymore. You know, let's not strap two people to a giant rocket and slingshot them into space and see what happens.
Technological optimism was a mainstay of the, you know, especially of the 70s, where a lot of those stories took place in the first couple decades of the 21st century. They drew an arc and kept on there, and it wasn't always strictly just, you know, government stuff. There was a lot of company stuff that came in there, and Fred Pohl played with that a lot, and Charles Sheffield, his stuff. His relatively near future stuff about the solar system tried to give you a lot of the grim and gritty day to day stuff that was going on in space travel, but it definitely hung its hat on technological optimism when it came to, you know, how far we'd go in a single swoop.
And I still predict that in 20,000 years it will look like what Isaac Asimov had in Foundation, and I'm willing for any of you guys to prove me wrong.
Well, was it who was it that was talking about the fact that, you know, really our we had two paths that we could have taken. One was essentially technology. One was power, and technology has continued to advance, but we haven't found a new power source, and so that's really why we haven't gone much further in space than we did in the 60s. You know, technology continues to advance. We now have in our hands a smartphone that has more computing power and can do more things than a supercomputer in the 60s, essentially. I mean, it's like a huge big deal. But it's still running on the same kind of battery. Does that make sense?
No, it makes sense, which is why I think a lot of science fiction was, you know, Larry Niven's Known Space was, we get technology from other races, and you know, Frank Herbert was, you know, we eat a drug and can bend space. You know, they always. I think a lot of it that was either recognized or, you know, a way to sidestep it was found early on. I mean, I don't think that's a blanket statement. Right. I agree with you to a big extent, but there was a lot of very popular SF that sort of jumped out of the way of the energy question early on.
Well, and also, I mean, you know, in the stories that I'm reading right now for the Golden Age stuff, I'm in 1941, and for a year and a half now, every spaceship has been powered by atomic power, mm-hmm. and every power plant has been a atomic power. And what are the problems going to be with atomic power? And in, you know, even Campbell's writing essays or editorials saying in 10 years the entire world will be powered by atomic power, and that didn't quite go the way they envision to do.
Well, it's because they keep building the power plants near, you know, fault lines.
Where's my atomic kitchen?
Hey, where would be the best place for this nuclear power plant to be? Well, there's a fault line right over there. Never had really an earthquake in the last 2.5 years, so it should be safe.
That's not the only place either. I mean, what's that? There's the one up the Hudson River, right? That's on a fault line.
They build them near rivers on purpose so they can pull that water in to cool. But anyway, I digress. You know, usually, especially in television, you get your science fiction and there's some sort of power source. There's a dilithium crystal, or dare I say it, unobtainium. Some rare, strange crystal or ore or something that, you know, they discover, and this, you know, really changes everything forever.
Don't forget broadcast electricity beaming down from orbital platforms. That was another big.
So anyway,
or the hubbub over cold fusion.
Cold fusion
that turned out to be nothing. Yeah.
Yep. And I remember that movie with Keanu Reeves. Final thoughts.
You sicken me. You truly sicken me sometimes.
I think that was actually even a good movie, if I remember correctly. It was like in the warehouse and they built the thingy and it was the cold fusion and it was, you know, the government guys were coming in to try to take it all over. And yeah, I remember that.
Patrick Hester can reduce speculation about future energy down to a Keanu Reeves movie.
All I have to say to you is, whoa. Dude. No. So any final thoughts? Let's go down the list. Paul.
I think we should keep dreaming about futures, not necessarily overly optimistic, camby-pamby, but at least not, I don't want a suite of novels, no offense to Mr. Bacigalupi, which are all crapsack worlds. I think science fiction is bigger and better than that. And I want my futures to be bigger and better than just crapsack futures that I can see from where I'm standing anyway.
John Stevens.
Ooh. I mean, I agree with Paul to an extent, but I kind of think what has to happen is that we have to think less about the purely predictive or speculative aspects and understand that we're often extrapolating real world concerns now and worry a little less about predicting things and more about exploring options. So positive options and negative options both have to be more fully explored, and part of that may just be breaking out of some of the paradigms we've used for such a long time. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, Paolo's world is very grim, but he does kind of break a certain mold in bringing that world out. It would be great if people took inspiration from that to build more positive and more negative views of not just the far future, but closer futures.
Sure. Jeff?
I would agree with John, and not just that, but I think you look at stuff like Elie Matisset and Timothy Zahn and S. Andrew Swan, these people that have done some very good future building in their science fiction with a lot of, you know, culturally and technologically, but a lot of those books, if you look at, you know, especially when they have the timelines in the front, there's always some big disconnect between here and there. Hamilton does it to an extent as well. And I always kind of like that because it sort of says right on the front, hi, this is not a predictive science fiction novel. This is sometime after we're all dead, something happens which enables us to move forward. And I always kind of like that.
Jamie Todd Rubin.
I agree with everybody. As entertainment, I like those big, bold futures, those big, bold visions. But I think it was Ben Bova, and I could be wrong, who says that science fiction writers are like, you know, explorers sent out to not predict, but kind of think about future circumstances and situations and ideas and bring back the stories to report on possible outcomes. And I think that's really the important part, outside of the entertainment piece, is to sort of, you know, look at these to some extent as thought experiments and what could happen in these situations, good and bad, dark and light, and maybe make people think a bit.
Very cool. Well, I get the final word, and so I'm just going to say, you know, if our scientists ate less bagels, we would be on Mars.
You know, I was thinking that there are quite a few, you know, if you consider a bagel to be a torus-shaped object, there are quite a few spaceships in science fiction that have that shape.
Taurus is pretty common.
Hey, and if you think about it, a lot of these futures, water is a scarcity, and you need water to make a bagel. So thanks, guys, for coming on. I appreciate it. I think we're going to wrap this one up. Obviously, there's tons of authors out there who have visions of the future, and I would love for people to come and go on the blog post and tell us who they are. Usual stuff this week. Visit sfsignal.com for all things sci-fi and speculative fiction. Follow John D on Twitter, twitter.com/sfsignal. If you're looking for me, I am ATFMB, twitter.com/ATFMB or ATFMB.com. I am also the other half of the Functional Nerds podcast, so go check that out. I occasionally write things for SF Signal, which makes Donardo pay me in bagels, just like the rest of us. I think that's it. We'll be back next week with a panel and an interview. So stick around for that, and we will see you later.